On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into James Harden's turnover struggles against the Pistons in Game 1 and something that has plagued him throughout his playoff career. We also take a look around the rest of the conference semis. How will the 76ers adjust in Game 2 versus the Knicks without Joel Embiid, who's ruled out? And in the West, Wemby and Reeves, both poor shooting nights. How can they bounce back? Also, Jaylen Brown gets fined $50,000 for his comments. Are his days in Boston over? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh. We do this Big Number show every Wednesday here at Yahoo Sports with your man, our man, Dan Devine. Dan, how are you?
I'm good, Tom. I'm trying to stay loose. You know, the games are coming fast and furious. We're the one day between games part of the calendar. And, you know, we're all just trying to stay fresh and get fresh and stay focused, really like nail the details. And I think our big number this week might have something to do with that.
Dan, this week's big number is 29. That is the number of times that James Harden in his playoff career has registered more turnovers than made field goals. And that includes Tuesday night. When you talk about the turnovers being more than his baskets, you never want to be on that list. But he had 7 turnovers in Game 1 against the Detroit Pistons, and he had 6 baskets. So that is another one, 29 in 181 playoff games. And that is just about the most we've ever seen in NBA history. And to put a frame on this picture, LeBron James has had 299 playoff games to his resume and has only registered, looking at this list, 11 of these games. So with 118 more playoff games, has 18 fewer than James Harden in this category. Russell Westbrook has 17 such games. And just adding more of these names on this list, if you combine LeBron James and Luka Doncic's total, James Harden would still have more of these crash out games, as I like to call them, when you have more turnovers than field goal makes. If you added LeBron, Luka, and Steph Curry, you would still have James Harden outranking that trio. If you added Kevin Durant, wow, Nikola Jokic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, LeBron James, Luka Doncic, and Stephen Curry, all 6 of those guys, they'd still have fewer than James Harden by himself. So there would be 27 crash out games amongst that combination of LeBron James, Luka Doncic, Stephen Curry, Giannis, KD, Nikola Jokic. Put them all together and you'd still have less than James Harden. And actually, in fact, Dan, this is kind of crazy. Jokic has never done this before in his playoff career. He's had 100 playoff games and has never had more turnovers than made baskets. So just to give you a perspective on what we're seeing from Harden, and I'm not saying that he's the only reason why the Cavs lost this game one. Down the stretch, he had some good moments. Donovan Mitchell was not at his best. Defense for Donovan Mitchell, a couple possessions there, I just didn't know what he was doing at all. In big moments, James Harden coughed up the ball that it didn't look good. Evan Mobley also not great in this game, getting beat up by Jalen Duren quite a bit. But I didn't expect to see James Harden and Donovan Mitchell struggle to assert themselves together in this way in this postseason against the Toronto Raptors, going to 7 games and all of the turnovers from James Harden. He's had 3 crash out games in the last 6 playoff games for the Cleveland Cavaliers, and he was acquired to be a stabilizer for this team, a floor raiser. And Dan, it happened again. And so for the Cavs to turn this series around, they just need to get more out of their star players, which seems quite an obvious statement, but it principally with James Harden, just cutting down on those turnovers and being able to score would help things quite a bit.
Absolutely. I mean, just the context of that's 16% of all of James Harden's career playoff games. He's had more turnovers than field goal. Like that's
one out of
wild.
Every 6 games. One out of every 6 games, really, he's going to do this.
Super, super duper wild. And so like where you wind up then is like, how do you mitigate it, right? Like, can you, which is a weird place to live when you're saying like, we expect this person who is first ballot Hall of Famer, you know, one of the, you know, what will go down as one of the greatest scorers and facilitators in NBA history. When we get to this time of year, and now we're not even talking about like game seven in the conference finals, we're talking about like, you know, the early parts of the early rounds, like how do we move around it? And can we get enough out of him and our team context construct to where that's not going to kill us? And the interesting thing coming out of game one for me is like, they almost did it, you know, like the Harden for all those turnover troubles, they're tied. It's 93 all with 5 minutes to go, in large part because Harden leads an 11-0 run early in the fourth quarter there. Like they, and with the kinds of things we've seen Harden use to his advantage over the course of a number of years, like the pattern recognition of they get an early run out and he sees right away, like, oh, the cross match after a Detroit miss, Duncan Robinson's on Donovan Mitchell. Hey, hey, get the ball over there. Like, let's move the ball that way so we can exploit that matchup, get Mitchell downhill, especially as Mitchell is not, you know, being his sort of typical elite self, get him an easy one against an overmatched defender coming in a scramble situation. You know, when he's able to work a mismatch on it for himself to get Duncan Robinson on him, I can get around him, get it to the paint, draw some fouls. I can get around him, get to the floater before Jalen Duren's able to come over and block the shot. Able to, you know, lure Asar Thompson into a three-shot foul, getting the strip on Jalen Duren under the basket. Like, he's doing things to contribute to what Cleveland's overall picture kind of needs to look like. But when you get to that five-minute mark, to me, that was where the kind of game shifts. Like, Harden gets them back, and then what happens is Cade Cunningham checks back into the game, right? And it's like Looper, you know, the Ryan Johnson movie where it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis. Like, the older version faces the younger version, and the younger version, Cade Cunningham checks back into the game and is like, oh no, I'm just going to control everything. I'm going to go make sure that I get easy buckets for my big man on the roll or in transition. We're going to get Jalen Duren, who is finally off the schneid after shedding the Orlando Magic. We're going to be able to get him going, finally get him some easy buckets. And like a 3 minute stretch, or a minute and a half stretch rather, where Cade just like takes over the game, three straight stops, three straight buckets, Cade is facilitating to get Duren going. And then all of a sudden it's two possession game again, and the Detroit's in charge, and Cleveland is kind of rattled. And then when you get down to those last couple of minutes, yes, Harden has a kind of a backbreaking turnover with 105 to go on a really nice defensive play from Danis Jenkins, by the way. Like, he gets beat around the edge, but when Duren steps up to stop the ball, Jenkins doesn't stop on the play. He like makes sure he gets himself in the pocket lane where Harden wants to slip that pocket pass through to Jalen Duren and breaks that, or to Evan Mobley rather, breaks that up. And then you wind up with the turnover that kind of seals it. So Detroit deserves plenty of credit for what they did on the back end of some of those things. But this is the gift and the curse, right? Like, Harden is good enough to get you there and can have a meaningful impact on you getting close. It's, can you get over the finish line? And that, to me, like, that was the argument behind the pairing in part, right? Like, all, and it's similar to what the people were saying on like the glass half full take with him in LA too, with the Clippers, where it was like, yeah, all of the clutch time stuff and the falling apart in big games, kind of who cares? Kawhi's there. We, like, you know, Kawhi will be the safety blanket for the security blanket for those things. He'll be the safety net for those things. Donovan Mitchell is supposed to be that. And I think maybe this is leading us to a reevaluation of whether we should think that of Donovan Mitchell, right? Like, you talk about, you know, a sort of underperforming expectations. Donovan Mitchell is scoring 6.5 fewer points per game than he has in each of the last two postseasons, shooting 44% from the field and 34% from three, barely positive assist to turnover ratio, and the lowest assist rate of his playoff career to this point in the postseason. And like, yeah, listen, playing whatever it is, 8 games against Scottie Barnes and Asar Thompson will do that to you, right? Like, there's no shame in that. But this is where, like, the whole theory of the case for Detroit, for Cleveland's construction is Donovan can be the best guy in one of these series. And so far, you know, he wasn't in the first round. I mean, even though they won that series, I don't know that he was the best player in that series or performed the best in that series. And it didn't look like it in game one either. And like, if that's going to be true, and you're going to have to just sort of deal with these crash out games, as you put them, from Harden, like, the case for Cleveland coming out ahead of even like a pretty, you know, shaky Detroit Pistons team in terms of what they can do on the offensive end of the floor, like, this case gets a lot harder to make.
Yeah, and Dan, I'm glad you brought up the Cade Cunningham comparison, because actually Cade Cunningham leads all players in turnovers this postseason. not James Harden, right? But
I'm even ahead of you on that one, James.
He's ahead of him on this one, Dan. He has scored 250 points, Cade Cunningham, to 166 for James Harden. So while they are having comparable turnover numbers, 45 for Cade Cunningham in the 8 games this postseason and 43 turnovers for James Harden in this postseason, 8 games as well, he has a 98-point advantage when it comes to assist points created plus your actual scoring points. So Cade Cunningham's creating a lot more on the positive side of the ledger than these turnovers that they're both creating at a high rate. But in net-net, Cade Cunningham's way more positive of an offensive force and an engine for the Detroit Pistons compared to what you're seeing with James Harden at this age. Maybe it shouldn't be so surprising that he's not able to go toe-to-toe with Cade Cunningham at this point. But another thing is that those 7 turnovers that James Harden had in game 1, 4 of those were live ball turnovers. 3 of them were dead ball turnovers where he's throwing the ball out of bounds or it's bounced off his foot. But on those 4 live ball turnovers, the Detroit Pistons converted them for 8 points the other way. Dunks, layups, in transition. And when you have James Harden coughing up the ball, a lot of those are going to be easy buckets on the other end because historically he just has not had a team that is able to recover in transition defense at a high rate. And with Donovan Mitchell on the team and Evan Mobley, Jared Allen, a lot of those cough-ups are going to lead to easy buckets for the Pistons that they're going to need a lot of this defense from Ausar Thompson and Danis Jenkins and Cade Cunningham. I think did a really excellent job defensively in this one. But I'm disappointed because I felt like I had high hopes and I thought this was like a good deal for the Cavs earlier this season. But after watching them in the first 8 games of this series or this postseason, I kind of feel like maybe they don't have the physicality that at so far in this series, obviously it's early, but Jalen Duren and the way that they took Cade Cunningham and Jalen Durham took him down the stretch, I wonder if we're not looking at a complete blow up in the offseason. James Harden has, I think, $13 million of his contract. His player option next year is guaranteed of that $42 million. And with all the weirdness around Donovan Mitchell and Evan Mobley getting that monster extension, it feels like the team with the highest payroll when you combine the luxury tax with $400 million this season, the most that they've spent ever in the Cavs history. This is on a precipice. And if they don't figure things out in game 2 with James Harden and Donovan Mitchell, I just don't know that we're going to see James Harden back in a Cavs uniform.
I mean, I think the we talked about it at the time at the trade deadline, the subtext, and I don't even know if it's subtext, it was pretty loud, of that deal was, this is the time, this is the window, this is what, like, we are building for to make this championship run now, to build, you know, this deep playoff run now. We are not thinking about what's going to happen in 3 years or when our core four eventually ages up together. Like, it's right now. This is our window to do it. And it has been, as you mentioned, sort of an underwhelming start for the Cavs in this postseason. And you bring up the physicality thing. I'm forever going to be like, my perception of this Cleveland core, it was shaped by that first round series against the Knicks a few years ago. And just like the inability that they had to consistently establish position, create good looks, like deal with the pressure that was going to be put on them under the boards or on the perimeter at the point of attack. And that's maybe unfair. You know, that's, you know, holding, you maybe hewing a little too close to your priors. And then you watch these series and you're like, I don't know that I'm seeing something demonstrably different in what the Cavs are doing. Now, some of that too, like, it's worth mentioning, Jared Allen played, I think, like 4 minutes in the fourth quarter of this game. And part of that is the early foul trouble, like, you know, Duren was winning that wrestling match and, you know, he's getting limited somewhat there. Part of it though is, you know, it gets back to, again, one of those sort of central tensions. When you have to win these games, what's your front court look like? Are you playing Evan Mobley at the 5? Are you playing your 2 bigs together? Can you play those guys with Dean Wade, who you need for defense, because you don't really have a good big wing? You took the swing on Isaac Okoro. You took the swing on DeAndre Hunter. You're trying to sort of mix and match and find that missing piece in the middle, and you've yet to do it. And so you need the shot creation from Harden and Mitchell. Both of those guys can be exploited defensively. And you need the defense on the wing of Wade, but then you need shot creation. And so you got to open up the floor more. And so it's this constant game of, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul kind of wherever you're going. And so Kenny Atkinson looks at his bench and he's like, I've got these options, but also sometimes I need Dennis Schroeder in there because someone's got to just get downhill to the basket. Or I need Jalen Tyson out there because I need a perimeter defender I can trust. Or I don't know, like Keon Ellis, remember how I liked him and now he's gone, which seems to keep happening for Keon Ellis, which is something we should probably keep in mind the next time we're all very excited about a Keon Ellis trade. But like all of these things, these are persistent years long across coaching staffs kind of issues for the Cavs. Like, who are the five guys you put on the floor when it's money time? And can that five include your two bigs? Like, these are existential fundamental questions we've had for years, and the answer continues to still be like, I don't know. And that's probably not great when it comes to, as you said, this is the time where you have to have those answers and answer them in the affirmative to get deep in the playoffs. And if you don't get that, I think everything starts to come on the table in terms of what comes next.
Look, there's still time. It's game one, but yes, as we've seen after even they embarrassed the Heat last year in the first round, had the greatest offensive series ever, they still were able to crumble last year after that Miami Heat sweep. And so part of me is just like, even we've seen the highs of this Cavs team in the core, and they still, when push comes to shove, they fall over. And I wonder, you know, when we talk about James Harden and Donovan Mitchell in the playoffs, I feel like you need a surplus of two-way guys. Guys that you're not, you talk about this Rob Peter to pay Paul thing, that they don't have enough guys that play both ends of the floor at an elite level. And that's what I think a lot of playoff basketball, it changes to guys who are physical. And when I hear Donovan Mitchell say, I need more free throws, and maybe the reason why I'm not getting free throws is because I don't flop, I'm like, I don't know, man. I watch a lot of these plays and I don't see you going through the defense and driving downhill and playing through contact and seeking out contact and playing physical. I don't think it's a matter of flopping or some sort of like ethical basketball from Donovan Mitchell. I feel like a lot of these guys on this Cavs team, I don't think they like to get dirty. I don't think they like to get play in the mud. And I think that that's what you need in the playoffs, is guys who are willing to play two elite levels on two elite level basketball on both ends. And I don't know if we see it. LeBron James, just as a note, he could have 17 crash out games in his next 17 games, and he still would trail James Harden. But it doesn't mean he's not a good player. James Harden still, like you said, first ballot Hall of Famer. And I will point out, a guy who has more of these crash out games on his resume is Magic Johnson, his 32. So
yeah, 32 and fit in keeping with the number. And I want to leave, as you mentioned, it's only game one. We shouldn't overreact. I want to leave the Cavs with, you know, a couple of positives here. Again, poor offensive performance by their standards, and it's still a one possession game, or it's high game with 5 minutes to go, one possession game into the closing minutes. Like, opportunities here, if you clean some of that up. And James Harden, you know, didn't look to like slough off responsibility for the turnovers when he was asked about them after the game, asked if they were a correctable issue. He says, yep, 1,000,000%. Like, some of them are, you look within first and you look at my turnovers. A lot of them are just on me and nothing they did, which led to, I don't even know how many transition points they had, but it was way too many. And if I had to put my print on one thing on the game, that's the game right there. Like, okay, I'm being reminded of Tommy Boy, where it's like, you know, you've identified what the smell is. Now the next part is washing it off, right? Like, it's the pine tree air freshener from the car. Now, James, you got to go scrub it off and go through and have a cleaner game too. But tighten that up. You can't turn the ball over 20 times and win. Like, I mean, if there's one way, if there's a recipe to deal with Detroit, it is, don't give them that oxygen of those run out buckets. Make them play in the half court against you consistently. And then, you know, Evan Mobley's ability to be versatile and, you know, guard on the perimeter and come back and protect the paint. Some of the ability that you've got to hide your weaker defenders, that stuff can matter more when you're not just scrambling to get back in transition on a live ball turnover. So clean up the turnovers, tighten things up, get a little bit more, maybe some more early touches for Mitchell, Mobley rather, to establish him, get a, you know, better performance late from Donovan Mitchell. And this could be there for you, but it is hard to see a pathway if the turnover issues don't abate and if the physicality doesn't ramp up.
Yeah, me believing in the Cavs, it feels like my brain has a thick candy shell, to steal a line from Tom. So, you know. So on that note, we are going to go take a spin around the rest of the three series in the playoffs. We're going to come back after the break and do that. We're going to hit the Lakers, OKC series, San Antonio, and Minnesota. And of course, on the other side of the East, we're going to talk about the Knicks that you've had a front row seat.
Way upstairs.
Metaphorically?
Way upstairs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
figuratively speaking, we'll talk about all that coming up in a little bit. All right, Dan, this week's big number, as a reminder, 29. That is the number of games that James Harden has had in his playoff career with more turnovers than field goals. And, you know, it wasn't everyone's shining moment in game one. James Harden was one of those, but also the Philadelphia 76ers did not have fun in their game one at the Garden. You were there for it. Can we kick off our three little numbers with that one right there?
For sure. First little number this week is 1.81. That's how many points per possession the New York Knicks scored when making Joel Embiid guard a pick-and-roll ball handler, according to Synergy's tracking. I wrote about this on Tuesday at Yahoo Sports in some more detail with some video and some more stats, so go check that out, please. But the bottom line here is the Knicks came out and said, you know, we played Philly in the playoffs a couple of years ago, and we torched their drop coverage. They want to play drop in the pick-and-roll with Embiid sinking back toward the paint and their perimeter defender getting over the top of the screen and like rear view contesting on Jalen Brunson. Brunson is going to be able to walk into, if the screen's good, he's going to have acres of space to walk into a pull up. If the bigger is a little higher up, he's going to have lob opportunities. There's plenty of things that he can do, right? We think that we have a mismatch there. We think that Embiid isn't moving so great, especially after a 7-game war against the Celtics. And, you know, he knocked his knee at the end of that series and was probable with a hip contusion. And now he's probable with an ankle sprain. Like, apparently, it's like everything is not working out so great for Joel Embiid's wheels. We know that Karl-Anthony Towns is a stretch big that can punish you if you're not too close up to touch on the screen. We think we've got an advantage here, and they just hammered it. They went to it from the opening possessions of the game and repeatedly went after it. And all of the things that Nick Nurse tried to do. And like, for people who say that, you know, they don't play defense in the NBA or there's no strategy, like I saw Nick Nurse toggle through like 9 different coverage options on the menu. Like, we're going to be in the deep drop. We're going to try to pre-switch and keep him beat out of the option. We're going to go with a hedge and recover. We're going to go to blitz. We're going to have him move off of Karl-Anthony Towns and move on to OG Anunoby. We're going to have him move on to Josh Hart. We're going to try everything we can sort of come up with to protect Embiid and, you know, find an answer to slow down this Knicks offense. And none of it worked. The Knicks absolutely reduced all of it to cinders. And it was in the plays where Embiid guarded the ball handler or the person the ball handler passed to, right? 11 for 14 from the floor, 29 points on 16 possessions, 1.81 points per possession, according to Synergy's tracking. It's basically a guaranteed bucket when he's in the action in game one there. So to me, obviously that was, you know, I wrote a bunch about it. That was like the way that I saw it, but I'm as you said, I'm there, I'm watching it that way. Do you, you know, as you watch it from home, did that seem to you like, all right, unsustainable shooting night, you know, they got, you know, the coin landed on heads 10 times out of 10, or is the way that Embiid was moving out there and the way that they were going after him, does that seem to you like a big issue for Philly in this series?
Oh, definitely an issue for Philly in this series, considering that they had one day off between game 7 and then this one. And that's going to be how it's going to be for the foreseeable future here. And Embiid's coming back from the appendicitis. And so they said, hey, you know, you've played the last 3 out of the last 4 games on the road and you've had one day off in between. You're probably not going to be in your top shape here and banged up. And that's always the case with Embiid. And here he cut off a question about them drawing fouls in the first half. And he goes, it did. I don't know. You've got to ask Jalen Brunson that. I don't think I got to the free throw line as much as I wanted, which if you're picking up on a theme in the Eastern Conference Finals, it's a lot of the referees and the foul drawing. I think Kelly Oubre said that Jalen Brunson's a good player. He just has a big head. Have you heard the Shane Battier theory, by the way, about flopping? and how players get the calls?
No, hit me with it.
He has a Louis Scola theory that if you have longer hair, and you have the ability to like flink your head back, if you have long hair like Jalen Brunson does and your hair just kind of flies all over the place, that's going to draw a lot more fouls. That's the Shane Battier school, the Louis Scola theory. And so I think Kelly Oubre probably subscribes to that theory, is that they're getting a lot more calls, but a lot of those shots that they were making had nothing to do with foul calls. They had to do with elite shot making. And for me, I think it's more to do with just an incredible display of shot making in this than any sort of like process, pun intended. I think the results were so strong in the Knicks' favor that I don't know if we do the same exact game and the shot locations and the pressure and the defensive coverages that we're seeing the Knicks score at that kind of clip. 10 different Knicks hit threes, which is a franchise record. They never in the postseason have ever had more than 8 players hit a three-pointer, but Kolek, Shamet, pretty much anyone who played, Diawara hit a three-pointer there down the stretch in garbage time. I think OG Anunoby hit one off the glass, you know, like it was just an incredible display of shot making. And some of those were Jalen Brunson stepping into a three-pointer off the dribble. You can expect some of those to be hit. But when you look up at the shot expectation, the expected field goal percentage for the New York Knicks in that game, once you account for the average value of the three-point shot, based on the defense, the shot location, how far away it was, the defender distance, they were expected to shoot 57% from the floor in game one, effective field goal percentage. They actually shot 74%, 17 percentage points higher than expected in that game. And so part of you says, all right, they found something with the coverages against Joel Embiid. But then part of me is also just like, that was one of the best shooting displays I have ever seen. And it would be a mistake to expect that to happen in game two. Oh, Dan, we've got some breaking news here. After all of that analysis, Shams Charania from ESPN reports, just in, Philadelphia star Joel Embiid has been ruled out for game two tonight against the New York Knicks due to ankle and hip injuries. What? Where did this come from?
Correct.
What?
Yeah, so, well, okay. So hold on. I know you're being a little facetious. You know, you're being a little egregious, Philbin, over here. But we do know that Embiid picked up the knock and his knee at the end of game 7 against the Celtics. He was listed as probable for game 1 with a right hip bruise, and then was shifted yesterday to probable with a right ankle sprain or strain, I believe. And so now I guess the aggregate impact of those leg injuries rules him out for game 2. But man, yeah, like not that you needed more Joel Embiid injury issues in the playoffs, because Lord knows we've seen a fair amount of that.
Yeah, this is a big bummer for the 76ers, obviously. The story was what a return. What a heroic return for Joel Embiid after the appendicitis, comes in and beats the Boston Celtics and saves the season. And then here he is in game 2 after that drubbing. And we went into detail about how bad the defense was, or the shot making for the Knicks was. And a lot of that was they were taking Joel Embiid. What the defense gave them was not very good defense from Joel Embiid and not very mobile. And now Embiid is out for game 2. Before this season, the series started, I picked the Knicks in 7. And part of my analysis was, it looks good. The Sixers look good after the Boston Celtics series. But can we really expect Joel Embiid to stay healthy for a 7-game series against the New York Knicks, considering the fact that he has missed playoff games in 4 out of the last 5 playoff series, Joel Embiid? And now that number turns to 5 out of the last 6 series Joel Embiid has missed games due to injury. It's devastating. They're going to have to rely on a lot more corner threes from Andre Drummond. Going to have to rely on a lot more defensive punch from the rest of the guys. And Paul George, the way he locked down Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, it's going to just require so much more from the 76ers team. And you've been on it. You know, the way that the TikTok of all the injury issues with Joel Embiid has happened, maybe we shouldn't be surprised, but it's alarming to me, Dan, that we went, maybe I have this wrong, but like, it wasn't like doubtful to out. It was out at lunchtime on game day, which suggests to me that this may potentially be more than just a one game injury.
Yeah. And you know, you're right. I'm piecing this together as we're going. So everybody bear with me, but from Adam Aronson at Philly Voice, Sixers, Adam, to write Sergey Sanchez listeners. The right hip soreness designation is new as of 1 PM on game day. The ankle sprain was Embiid's initial listing for the game. He was listed as probable for game one before playing. He was probable for game two as well, but will be sidelined. I think when you're talking about Joel Embiid and injuries and injury reporting and injury discussion, expect the unexpected is kind of a good rule here. Things will come out of nowhere before you know what to expect. But speaking of what to expect, I think that like, all right, so as you mentioned, and as we talked about in the run-up here, so much of the Knicks game one game plan was how do we exploit Joel Embiid's, you know, lack of lateral mobility and his, and the difficulty to get him going on the perimeter. And so now maybe it's Drummond in the starting lineup. That's, you know, Nick Nurse has leaned there and been comfortable with that. You would imagine more minutes for Adembona, who had a brief cameo in game one that was exclusively filled with fouls and turnovers, but a lot of also aggression. And he allows them to play a little bit differently in the pick and roll. He's a more mobile center, so he can get up to the level of the screen. When he was in the game briefly, he did like string out a trap on a Brunson pick and roll and strung him out to the sideline. So they can be a little bit more active there. Just in terms of the downstream effects of this, right? Like, this Nick Nurse was basically playing like 6-7 guys at the end of, by the end of the Celtics series. And then he expanded his rotation a little bit in game one, gave some early minutes to Justin Edwards, although most of that was like him to do hack-a-Mitch on Mitchell Robinson. You know, this may be, you got to find minutes somewhere, right? So Dominic Barlow, do you get some more opportunities? You know, where do you find more minutes in this rotation for what was already a pretty thin team? And then just like, this is not exactly super nitty gritty high level analysis, but Tyrese Maxey, no opportunity for you, no time for you to feel your way into the game as you did in game one, where I believe he didn't even take a shot in the first quarter, or having, he said after the game, like, I had one shot attempt, but it wasn't a real shot. The ball kind of squirted out of my hands. Not an option now in game two if Joel Embiid is not there. And as we saw, we'll give it, put a stat to it, whatever it is, the big number. During the regular season, with Embiid on the floor, Tyrese Maxey's usage rate under 25%. With him off the floor, well over 31%. And so they are going to have to build that offense out of Tyrese Maxey, you know, working in the pick and roll, trying to find opportunities to hunt Karl Anthony Towns in the drop, trying to hunt Jalen Brunson, put him through action, make those Knicks defenders work in a way that they were not really asked to do or tasked with in game one. And, you know, we've seen there's two times the Knicks played, or the Knicks and Sixers played the season without Embiid. In the first game back in December, 116-107 Sixers win with Maxey going for 30 points and 9 assists. And then the last one, the most recent one, was back in February, right before the trade deadline, or right before the All-Star break, rather, 138-89 Knicks win. But both Embiid and George were out for that one. So Maxey, you know, was able to score, but it didn't really matter because nobody else was able to get going. So Paul George obviously changes the math and the matchup there, but you need a monster Maxey game if Embiid is not able to go to be able to get this split 1-1 before you head back to Philly. And if they can't do that, and if it's 2-0 and Embiid's status for the remainder of the series is up in the air, you know, obviously the odds look a hell of a lot slimmer for Philadelphia to pull the upset here.
I mean, it's all icing on the cake at this point. Like, for Sixers fans, after they vanquished all of the demons with the Boston Celtics, maybe it feels like this is all just house money at this point, but still, it's a huge bummer. I'll remind people, Tyrese Maxey's career high in the playoffs came game five against the New York Knicks 2 years ago. He scored 46 in an overtime win against the Knicks at Madison Square Garden. So we're going to probably have that.
You want a fun fact from that one?
Yeah.
So that's the game where it's, you know, the he has to force overtime. He hits like a couple of crazy shots, a couple of big threes late to force overtime. And then they go and they win that game. Now, Embiid's available for that game. He has a monster overtime. Yes. But that is a tear up what you're writing. Go back and rewrite it. At the Madison Square Garden press room, they close it down 2 hours after all the post-game availabilities are done. So I'm scrambling, trying to write, trying to grab video, trying to transcribe. They're like, you got to leave. I filed my story that night from an ATM vestibule. I had to go down like around the block, a mile on like 34th Street in an ATM vestibule. Dude comes in with a dog just hanging out with me while I'm writing my story. It was not the most glamorous or probably safest situation I've ever been a part of doing it after the game, but Tyrese Maxey put me through a tough night on the job. He's going to have to put the Knicks through a tough night on the job for the Sixers to want to be able to get level in this series. But man, what a pipe bomb dropped in the middle of the series, you know, like unbelievable.
Yeah. Watch out ATM machines in New York City tonight.
Yes.
Dan will be there. No doubt. If he has Maxey another.
Hopefully not. Hopefully the story's done earlier than that this time. But you know, listen, ask every editor I've ever had. They're not gonna lay the money on me to get it in by deadline. They'll say, don't write from the vestibule, Dan, and we'll see where we go.
Godspeed, Dan. All right, with this Embiid news out of the way, let's get on with the rest of the show.
We'll move on to our second little number this week, which is 8. That's how many three-point shots Victor Wembanyama took during game 1 against the Minnesota Timberwolves. He had only taken that many triples 14 times in 64 games during the regular season. He had 25 such games last year. He had only taken 6 three-pointers total across the final 2 games of round 1 against Portland. We talked a number of times this season about Wembanyama making a more concerted effort to establish himself down low, cut down on the three-point shot, led to like a massive increase in efficiency for him, helping drive the Spurs up the offensive charts and then to 60-plus wins and back to the playoffs. And in game 1 here, biggest game of his career in the NBA, takes nearly half of his shots from deep and doesn't make any of them. I've gone back and watched some of this, but admittedly, I was covering the Knicks game live, so I didn't see this one as it happened. What did you make of Victor Wembanyama's offensive performance in game 1, which, as we see here, the Timberwolves stole in game 1 despite Anthony Edwards' injury, despite being without Ayo Dosunmu, despite being without Dante DiVincenzo? Go in and they take game 1 in San Antonio, take home court advantage. And with Wembanyama having a really rocky go of it, did you see a shot selection issue, something the Wolves were doing particularly, a little bit of both, something else entirely? What did you make of Vic's migration to the perimeter in game 1?
Yeah, Dan, Wemby did not like having Julius Randle on. The physicality, the size, it's a lot different than having Tamani Kamara, and a lot shorter version of that is Drew Holiday, but a lot shorter than Julius Randle, right? So now you go against these guys who've been playoff tested, been in the conference finals each of the last 2 years, and you're looking at Anthony Edwards, who has that energy as the alpha, as the main character of that Minnesota Timberwolves team. It's very different than the previous iteration that they faced, the San Antonio Spurs faced in the first round. So this is different. Julius Randle, when he guarded Victor Wembanyama in game 1, in 24 possessions, Wemby shot the ball twice. One out of every 12 possessions with Julius Randle guarding him. Against Rudy Gobert, he had 10 field goal attempts in 35 possessions. So one out of every 3 and change possessions, he's going at Rudy Gobert. But against Julius Randle, you saw one, maybe the most interesting play in that game 1 was Anthony Edwards got a just slaloming into the paint, uncontested layup, and Victor Wembanyama was cleared out by a Gortat screen from Julius Randle, who was just like, I'm stronger than you. I'm stout. I'm able to basically clear out the lane. And that physicality, yes, Victor Wembanyama had 12 blocks in that game, despite what Chris Finch says. He said 4 were goaltends, but rewatching it, I think maybe 1.5 was a goaltend. But anyway, when we look at Wemby, we talked about this before the season. One of the reasons why I picked him for MVP was because of all of the paint touches, all of the post touches that he was getting, and it was a harbinger of what you were going to see in the regular season, which was true. But it all kind of unraveled and reset back to those bad habits from last year in this game one. He did not like that physicality from Julius Randle, and it showed. I will point out he had zero post-up touches in this game one. He had one in game five of the Trailblazers series. You had one in game four of that series. You had zero in game two and zero in game one of the Portland series from Victor Wembanyama, according to the NBA.com player tracking technology. So that is two post touches in five games. And in the regular season, he averaged three per game. So in normal rate, he would have 15 post touches by now in this postseason, and he has two. So it does kind of alarm me a little bit that it seems like he's reverting back to old habits, and I would expect watching the game film that Wemby will come out with a little bit different energy and a little bit different inviting that physicality on the offensive end. That certainly he played defensively well, but offensively, I think that physicality from Julius Randle and the rest of the team got in his head a little bit.
And you could see it on just where he's getting the ball, right? If he's catching it on a roll, but they're meeting him at the free throw line, they're crowding his catch. Or if he's getting it at the elbow, there's a switch off, and Jaden McDaniels has given up half a foot to him, but he's underneath. He's there, like in the airspace. And Victor, wonderful attributes as he has, and as many advantages as he can bring to bear, he's not just going to bulldoze through those guys. He's not going to like bully through a straight line to the rim through Jaden McDaniels, through Rudy Gobert, through Julius Randle. And so, yeah, I wonder, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the disparity in how many shot attempts versus Randle and how many shot attempts versus Gobert. You wonder if like maybe it's just a little bit more familiarity with Gobert and where he can get to, you know, obviously they've known each other for years and, you know, played together with France and stuff like that. Like the idea of maybe a little more experience with how Randle is trying to get to him opens up some more, like, oh, this is how I counter and get to that. But you're absolutely right. It's not like this is, to me, I think it's partially a story of this is Victor Wembanyama seeing what playoff blueprints and game plans look like for him at the NBA level. And he's going to have to make the adjustment just like so many stars have before him. And some of it is like, listen, it's time to give more flowers to these Minnesota Timberwolves, to Chris Finch and his coaching staff, to the defensive core there. They just do not seem stressed or bothered or care about how cool your offense is supposed to be and what your rep is. We are going to drag this into the mud, and we trust our ability to win the fist fight down here, even if you have like your stats are better, right? And notable too, just saw this come across the wire from our guy John Krasinski at The Athletic. Ayo Dosunmu is in for tonight for game two for the Minnesota Timberwolves. So they are getting some reinforcements, a little bit more help, a little more ball handling, and another guy who, by the way, is going to be pretty physical when he gets on the ball there. So something to keep an eye on in game two here. Our third and final little number, 0.471. That is how many points per shot attempt Austin Reeves averaged in game one against the Oklahoma City Thunder. If less than half a point per shot attempt sounds bad, that's because it is. He went 3 for 16 from the field, which is not the Austin 3-16 you're looking for, scoring 8 points in 36 minutes with 6 assists and 4 turnovers as the Thunder beat the Lakers 108-90 to take a 1-0 lead. 0.471, the least efficient scoring night Austin Reeves has had in more than 2.5 years. 0.3.85 yes. Points per shot attempt in an October 2023 loss to the Sacramento Kings. Tom, we knew offense was going to be a problem for the Lakers with Luka sidelined throughout this postseason. Obviously, Reeves missed the first 4 games of the Rockets series before coming back. And they had the lowest offensive rating and the highest turnover rate of any team to survive round one. The Thunder famously pretty good at forcing and punishing turnovers, so it looked like it was going to be some tough sledding there. But the theory of the case for LA is going to require phenomenal defense, great work on SGA, which our guy Kelly Eco wrote a story about that and the defensive game plan the Lakers are putting into play on Yahoo Sports this morning, so go check that out. But it also is going to require Reeves doing something to be able to help out LeBron James. And 93 offensive rating with Reeves on the floor in game one. They scored just 7 points in 7 minutes where he was on the ball with LeBron on the bench. Since his return, 14 for 46 from the floor, 30.4%, 2 for 17 on threes, 11.8%. And the Lakers have an 87.2 offensive rating when he plays without LeBron, which is rough. You know, how much of this, Tom, do you think is just oblique strain, missed a bunch of time, pretty tough to come back from? And you just, you know, maybe we're not going to see the best of Austin Reeves here, even if you were playing somebody that's not the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Yeah, if this was the regular season, I don't think he's playing right now. Clearly banged up. Oblique strains are no joke, especially with a guy who needs wiggle, needs that kind of shiftiness to get to his buckets and get you off balance. If he doesn't have his core strength and doesn't have his wind underneath him, I don't think Austin Reeves is going to be able to help the Lakers in this series. We're not hearing great things out of the Luka Doncic camp, or at least the word about his ability to come back in this series. So we are this is danger zone for the Lakers. LeBron is doing as much as he can as 41-year-old LeBron James can, but this offense is putrid. I mean, we're talking about since the start of the postseason, they had in regulation 107 points in game one against the Houston Rockets, 101 in game two, 101 in game three, 96 in game four, 93 in game five, 98 in game six. And then here, absent a Jake LaRavia Hail Mary three-pointer at the end of the game, this would have been an 87-point outing for the Lakers. And honestly, they got maybe the worst Shai Gilgeous-Alexander performance you can expect, and they still were basically blown out by 20 points in this game. I don't see how there's much glass half full here for the Lakers. I know they stuck with it for about 40 minutes in this game, and eventually OKC pulled away, but I don't see, if Austin Reeves is going to look like this, I don't see how the Lakers are going to even win one game.
Yeah, just funny. Like LeBron was asked last night, where are the offensive issues coming from? He said, the guy who averaged 37 a game, that's the issues right there. Like they don't have Luka. And so it does feel increasingly like they're drawing dead. I mean, even when healthy, Reeves is, as you mentioned, he's a player that really thrives more on craft and rhythm and touch. And Oklahoma City is a machine built to sap those things away from you. They don't have to throw Lu Dort on him to be able to disrupt that. They have a number of other guys who can get on the ball and make life difficult. Even with Dort taking on the bulk of the LeBron assignment, and without wing Jalen Williams, it's still, you know, AJ Mitchell can make him work. Alex Caruso, when he gets in the game, can make him work. Cason Wallace can make him work. The bigs can get out and you know, deal with him on the perimeter. They can show a second line of defense there. So there's just like a lot for Reeves to deal with. Setting aside the fact that, by the way, he took a pretty gnarly shot on a screen. I think it was called a foul on Smart because Marcus Smart kind of like shoved SGA into the screen. But SGA went straight into Reeves' sternum, yeah, and Reeves goes back on the ground. And like, I'm sure that doesn't feel great when you're just coming back from a strain or any time. I mean, the general idea here is like, I'm watching that game and I'm thinking the Thunder, and credit to the Lakers defense for forcing a lot of those turnovers and for finding some ways to make the OKC offense, which we know the offense, the half court, especially when they don't have Jalen Williams, can get clunky. It's not like the most smooth running half court offense you ever seen. It's not the beautiful game Spurs or nothing, but the Thunder didn't really seem all that smoothly operating on offense. SGA had, as you mentioned, maybe the worst game you're going to see from him. And it was like 15, and it didn't seem close. Like the Lakers never seemed, or once it got past like maybe the first half, it didn't seem like they were really all that much there. And without Austin Reeves finding some way to break free of this and get a rhythm and get on task, like I'm not sure there's any reason to believe that the Lakers are going to be able to make this a longer series.
Yeah. Austin Reeves has missed 14 straight three-pointers. For a team that's desperate for three-point shot making, not what you want. So yeah, Dan, I think this is going to be a quick series. We were hoping that we would see Luka like kind of on the mend and ready, like ramping up, doing some workouts, maybe playing some 5-on-5 by now. But with this oblique injury for Austin Reeves, a 41-year-old LeBron, and Luka nowhere near returning, it seems. I just think It was a valiant effort going against the Houston Rockets that was shorthanded without Fred VanVleet, Kevin Durant, and Steven Adams. But no shame in the way that this Lakers season has ended, given the injuries. It's been a brutal injury season for them, but I just don't see how against this Oklahoma City Thunder, the Dobermans that they have on this team, I just don't see how Austin Reeves is going to be able to come back and play at the level that they need for them to overcome this. We will do the Jaylen Brown discussion here after we discuss all the rest of the playoff series. The one big variable in the league that could shift everything is if Brad Stevens decides, you know what, Jaylen Brown, that might have been your favorite season of your career, and it might be your last season in the Boston Celtics era. So we'll talk about Jaylen Brown's fine that he just got from the league office and his comments and what Brad Stevens said on Wednesday at the press conference, end of season press conference, coming up after the break. All right, Dan, so April 20th. Okay, so this is after game one of the Sixers series in which the Celtics blew out the Sixers, game one. I remember reading in my inbox from True Hoop a little report from David Thorpe, who trains NBA players, used to work at ESPN, and talks quite a bit with agents, executives, coaches, players, works them out in the offseason. And for a lot of players, they're working out right now because it is the offseason for most of the teams right now. And he had on April 20th a little ditty that I want to just share to everyone because this was after a win. This was after a blowout win for the Celtics. He said, I'm going to pass along some information that I don't see as news. I have no idea what the truth is. I just know that there are insiders telling me this. I'll tell you my circles between the players and agents and people I talk to constantly. It's taken as fact that Jamal Mosley is a done deal to leave Orlando to become the next head coach of the Pelicans. He and Paolo Banchero never got along. And you're always going to fire the coach before we fire the player, right? And the other one is Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are done. They aren't going to play together anymore after this season. That's what everyone's telling me. Okay, well, Jamal Mosley has been let go. And we'll see what happens with the New Orleans job. But he also predicted that this season was going to be done with the Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown partnership after they blew out the Sixers, and he wrote that. And so now, as we're sitting here, it feels like that was kind of a canary in the coal mine, that even when things are great, it seemed like there was a lot of chatter here. And T-Mac also coming out here on his cousin's podcast with Vince Carter, saying he hears a lot of stuff in Boston that things are not going well with Jaylen Brown. And then he was fined $50,000 for comments, complaints against the officiating. And the big bomb that he dropped there was that this was his favorite year of his career after winning the finals and winning the championship and being the finals MVP and being the Eastern Conference final, Eastern Conference MVP. This was his favorite year, the one in which Jason Tatum was gone for pretty much the entirety of the season with an Achilles tear. And they just got bounced in the first round. So, Dan, all of this lends me to believe that Brad Stevens came out and said, yep, everything's good over here. Nothing to see here. And yeah, he did talk today. What are your thoughts about this situation before we get to Brad Stevens' comments?
So just in fairness to Jaylen Brown, because I'm nothing if not fair, especially to streamers, right? It was one of my favorite groups of people to be fair to. When he did offer some context for why it's his favorite year. One, he said he was saying it to his chat, right? Can we get a W in the chat? He said that talking regularly, streaming about this season, what quote was like therapy every single day or once a week, whatever I was doing, just being able to get on here and give you guys a perspective on how all these narratives are going left and right, given to you all straight from the horse's mouth. So I think part of it is he's saying it's my favorite year because it's the year I became a streamer, right? So there's one thing there. Like it's not necessarily saying anything to do with who was or was not in the lineup with him. He did also then say, quote, just being able to be part of a group that through the uncertainty came in to fight and compete, come into the war. I'll take a team like that any day of the week. Now, does that extend to, again, who was not in the lineup? I don't know. But this is him, you know, it's bigging up the Kadas and the Garzas and the Ugos and the Jordan Walshes of the world. Like maybe the benefit of the doubt for saying like, yes, I've achieved more in the past, but the circumstances through which we achieved here are ones that I appreciate. So, like, let's give Jaylen Brown the benefit of the doubt that maybe he wasn't saying this is the best year because I got to be the number one option and I got to shoot all the shots. Let's give the benefit of the doubt. However, I think you're right to note that it's an interesting confluence, and the timing of all of it is kind of interesting to say there's this, and then there's the T-Mac thing, and then that's all right before Brad Stevens has to go talk to the media. And Brad Stevens, in doing so, like, he did respond to it. Do you have the Brad quote over there?
Yeah, Brad was, he said, I talked to Jaylen for a little bit, and it was a great conversation, very positive. He has not expressed those frustrations to me.
Just to the chat.
So he expresses it to everybody else. But when my door is open, Brad Stevens says, my door is open, and everyone on the roster, 1 through 16, whether it's JB or JT, they can come in and voice their frustrations to me. But he hasn't done that yet. So it's not a non-denial. I think Brad Stevens is kind of frustrated too, is just like, hey, can you stop telling people all these things, whether it's to T-Mac or whether it's to your streamers? If you have a problem, bring it here and we can air it out and we can talk about this. And I can understand why in the podcast era and the streaming era and the social media era, a lot of these executives and coaches are just frustrated that the players are speaking to other people outside of that circle, that cone of trust, and it's creating issues within the organization. Now, he denied that this was a problem, but there are big questions that they have. Brad Stevens won the Executive of the Year award, as voted on by the executives of his peers, for basically doing a private equity slashing. Like, it's really strange when you look at the Boston Celtics. Why he got the award was because he shaved off so much of the payroll, and this seemed like a financial decision, not a basketball decision. The additions to the team, like, I can't look at anything and say that was more Brad Stevens than it was Joe Mazzulla's amazing coaching in the regular season. It wasn't like a huge addition that made a big difference in the playoffs or in the regular season. I guess the Hugo Gonzalez draft pick was great, but he also didn't play much in the postseason. So I don't know. It's all very weird. It's all very strange. And I'll just say, I don't think that this is all just smoke and there's no fire here. I'm not going to say that I think this is all going to end here, but I would not be surprised. I would say it's a coin flip whether Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are going to play again going forward. It would not surprise me in the least if Jaylen Brown had played his last game as a Boston Celtic. And maybe they bring him back, but it's going to come at a pretty penny. And with Jason Tatum coming off an Achilles tear, I mean, you're Brad Stevens. He said it in his postgame press conference, or his postseason press conference. They've got to get a whole lot better if they want to compete at the top of the East.
Yes, no doubt about it. And there's, like, just for the record, because I don't think we actually said it, like, Tracy McGrady, I believe, like, sort of considered a mentor figure for Jaylen Brown, like, going back to their time, you know, Jaylen Brown being young in Atlanta and T-Mac being somebody that he connected with. And what T-Mac actually said on that podcast was that Jaylen Brown's quote, his frustrations lie deeply within the organization and other things that we don't really have the details to. There's just been a lot of stuff that I've been hearing just going on with the Boston organization with JB. I think part of him is like, I showed you guys more of who I am as a basketball player, not only just what I did on the court, but the leadership I displayed within this team. You've seen that not having our best player in JT, you've seen a different side of me and what I'm able to bring to the game of basketball. So all that stuff, I think, just came into play with him and his frustration. And yeah, so maybe there is a sense of like, now that you know I'm capable of more, I've always known I'm capable of more, I'm fitting into a smaller role because that's what is required of me. You know, let's allow me to be me to a greater degree. It is perhaps also worth noting that Jaylen Brown is eligible for an extension of his contract come the end of July. I think July 26th is the date. He can get up to an additional 2 years and $141.9 million added to his contract, according to Bobby Marks of ESPN. So maybe some of this storm cloud gathering and some of these frustrations and some of the questions of who's going to be where and with whom and who's going to be prioritized in what way, like maybe some of that has to do with an extension coming up for a guy who's, 10 years deep in his career and thinking about those sorts of things. So, I mean, on one hand, feel like there's been in the media discussions of, do you split up Tatum and Brown for basically the entire time they've been together, it feels like, and it hasn't happened yet. And Celtics are perennially one of the best teams in the NBA and won a championship and went to another finals and are, one of the most successful, they've been like the most successful team of this decade, right? So, maybe it's still more much ado about nothing and, this too shall pass. It does seem like the circumstances of this season and of the way this season ended and of the way that Jaylen Brown has been talking since the end of it. As you mentioned, Stevens acknowledging like the conference has risen up around us and we need to rise with it. Create some interesting tensions and some interesting questions they've got to answer this summer.
For sure. And there's going to be some teams, and Brad Stevens said it at the press conferences, with the new rules, the draft rules, the tanking that we saw this year is not going to happen. And the East is going to get a lot harder with this new draft class coming in, and we've got a lot of work to do. So it does seem like as far as Brad Stevens is going to do, he's going to suggest that something big is going to happen this offseason. And it's not just going to be slashing payroll every chance they get. And again, they took Drew Holiday, turned him into Anthony Simons, and then turned him into Nikola Vucevic, who could not get off the bench there in game 7. So it just, it seemed like either Joe Mazzulla and Brad Stevens are not on the same page, or Brad Stevens and Jaylen Brown are not on the same page, or Jaylen Brown and Joe Mazzulla are not. Something seems to be afoot, and maybe they'll just all kumbaya, ubuntu, and get back together in the offseason, and everything's going to be fine. Or maybe not. Tell you what, everything's fine on this show. Thanks to our squad behind the scenes. Thank you to Brad, Emmy, Sarah, Ryan, everybody who works on this show. Thank you so much, and appreciate everyone who has already subscribed to the YouTube channel, Yahoo NBA, where you can find us, the Dunker Spot, the Kevin O'Connor Show, as soon as it goes live. We got another show on Thursday. Kevin O'Connor and I are going live at 11:30 Eastern. So be around for that. And be sure to give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to us on the podcast. Dan, it's been a pleasure. Enjoy the game tonight. And enjoy your front row seat there with Jimmy Fallon. It'll be great.
Yep, that's exactly where they put me at MSG. Thanks so much, Tom.